Clancy I from Venice, California.
My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here for the sixth anniversary of this specific group. It seems like I've heard that name somewhere before. But I'm glad to be here, and I'm really glad to be a part of it. I want to thank Bob for what I thought was an excellent description of the group's ethic. You squeezed a lot in the 16 minutes, Bob. Yeah. I'm one of the few guys in the world he has to take crap from. But I've been coming up to Las Vegas a long time. I first came here, I guess, when they started that end-of-the-month meeting in 1960. And I came up to be the first speaker. And the secretary then, a guy named Les Eccles, who's now dead, so I can mention his name, he started it. He and a guy named Tom O'Neill, they're both dead. Everybody's dead that I know, I guess. And they sent me a note and said, of course, we expect you to wear a shirt and tie. And so I've always gone by that when I come to Las Vegas. But tonight I heard an argument against it that really impressed me. I mean, the guy had a lot of weight behind his remarks. And never get smart with the people who got the microphone after you. That's the first thing. But I have been coming here a long time and, you know, grown old and feeble. I was just thinking, it's kind of interesting how it happens. When a few years ago, I turned 70, and the doctor started giving me iron tablets for my blood. I don't know what the hell that's supposed to do when you're 70. But I've been taking it for years. And then recently, I'm not going to tell you why, but I'm reading so much advertising and I have stirrings. And I tried my first Viagra. And I didn't realize that if you're taking iron tablets, you're not supposed to take Viagra. And now every 6 hours, I face north. Well, I'm sorry I said that. But it's an interesting thing. Alcoholics Anonymous, as Bob described it, is certainly true. Alcoholics Anonymous is a strange thing. It's made up around the country and around the world in pockets of enthusiasm. There's a pocket of enthusiasm where people are involved and doing this and going to places doing things. Then you can go for miles and just dull, drab. Well, my counselor said I should go to a meeting again. What's this crap about the steps you're talking about? And then you get to another pocket of enthusiasm. There's great pockets of enthusiasm. And they keep A going, and they will enable it to keep going and growing. But it's a funny thing about a pocket of enthusiasm. Everywhere you see a pocket of enthusiasm, it is always based on a strong sponsorship ethic. There's always a strong sponsorship ethic in every pocket of enthusiasm. And I suppose the reason for that is, when there's strong sponsorship ethic, people get led into taking actions they would not take left to their own devices. Not very many people volunteer to write a fourth step. Not very many people want to read their shortcomings to somebody else. Not very many people want to make amends to people they hate. Not very many people want to do a lot of things. You say, well, I'll do it someday, but not right now. But with strong sponsorship, you overcome that. I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years before I stayed sober, almost 10 years. And I became an authority on the evasions and the intellectual superiorities. And I came to AA as a young man, and I was kind of a high-bottom drunk and rather successful. Then over the years, I became a medium-bottom drunk. I stayed intermittently financially successful. And then I became a low-bottom drunk. And that didn't last long, but it lasted long enough for me to look around one day, and I was in a strange town, and two big guys were throwing me out of a Skid Row mission and said, stay out of here, you mooch. And I tried to explain to him, I'm not really a mooch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the L.C. Elmer ads for the board and company, old ads, were running that very week in Life and Time and Serving Post and New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside of that damn old mission on the corner of 4th and Los Angeles Street in Los Angeles, where I didn't know anybody. I knew one guy. I told him I'd been in a car accident, and he gave me some money, and I went back to see him again, and he refused to give me any more. He said, you haven't had a car accident. I called Dallas. You're just you've turned into a bum. Don't come back to the station. He was a radio station guy. And I stood in that street corner, and I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what the feeling was. I think what it is now, because I've seen it in other people. And I'm sure it's happened to some of the people in this room, to suddenly realize there's no friendly direction. Every direction is equally negative. There's no direction to go where there's going to be people glad to see you, where people want to, oh, hi, welcome home again. And it's a terrible feeling. And but I stood there, and it was raining, and I was sick, and there was blood on the front of my shirt and vomit. And I didn't know what to do. If some old guy would come up to you that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. You can't even get a job washing dishes now. You've lost all your... guy gave you a car to drive from Phoenix or Dallas to Los Angeles. You got drunk in Phoenix and lost the car. Never saw it again. That's all your clothes, all your ID. You haven't got a driver's license. You got nothing. Your little mother up in Wisconsin is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you because your stepfather's so tired of watching you call her and play on her emotions. So she'll go down to her tiny little bank account and take out a few more dollars and send to her little boy. He'd rather have her dead, think you're dead than the way you are. And the guy might have said, you know, you've been monkeying around AA now for almost 10 years. And you sit in these meetings when you're in trouble and you smirk and think about these little idiots and their little steps and their little turn over to God and wish you were stupid the way they were so you could accept it. But you're not. Now you're dying on the street. Why don't you go back to AA? He might have said, go back to AA one more time and admit you're an alcoholic and see what happens. And if I were really feeling honest, which I may or not have been, but I had to say, pal, it isn't the way it looks. I'm not really an alcoholic. And he might have said, prove it. And I would have no way to prove it. I'd have to tell him, get away from me. I'll smash your face. Because I have no answer to that. But I knew this, that there was something terribly wrong. I could have told him that. There's something wrong with me. There's no question about it. I wish it were alcohol. It would have saved me a lot of trouble. But I had trouble since I was a little boy. When I was a little boy, I remember feeling that somehow that there's something different about me. I don't know. There's something missing in me. And I don't know what it is, because at a distance, I get along great with people. But up close, it's almost as though they see something missing in me. They don't like me anymore. And I don't know what it is. Nobody ever tells me what it is. And I don't fit in. I was a young kid. I could read a lot, and I could read fast, and I was kind of relatively smart. So I was shoved ahead in school a year and a half. And so that put me in another thing, a smaller kid with all bigger kids in the class. And I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, a very strict church where you just know you're gone from the get-go. And I always used to laugh and think of the people in AA saying things like, I've been searching for God for 30 years. I never searched for God 10 seconds. If you want to know where God is, he slowly circles the Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And he gives it to sinners. And he gives it to Catholics. Which was all right with me until I became one and married the other. But I've always had a lot of problems. I thought when I grow up, it'll be all different. It's almost as though if you're supposed to feel like this in life, it always seemed for one reason or another, I always felt like this a lot. And I thought there's got to be a way out of that. And I ran away from home when I was 15 because I felt bad. The war had started, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco. Small, dumb little puke with pimply faces. And I was going to join the Marine Corps and go kill Japs. What a joke that would have been. And the guy said, you're too young to get here. Why don't you try the Merchant Marine? They'll take anybody that's breathing. So I went to the Coast Guard office. ought to be in the merchant marine. I said, well, you see, I see you put down 16 on your application. I said, yes, I did. I lied about that, too. He said, well, you're only 16. You have to have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. And then, they were just crying for guys. They gave me temporary Seamen's papers there, sent me to National Maritime Union where I signed something for some dues or something. They took another guy out of the dock. That afternoon, I'm going to load a torpedo warheads going to the South Pacific. And I'd never even seen an ocean before. It was really fun for about an hour. Then it kind of tailed off after that. But I was in a room. They called it a cabin. It wasn't a room. Cabins have logs. But I was in a room with these three guys who were the worst type of people that any small, skinny, Norwegian Lutheran little puke can be with. And these people are called men. I said, what the hell are you supposed to be? And I felt rejected. I realize now why they had such an attitude is because there were four men to a watch, or four men in a group who did work together in the ship, and I was their fourth man, and they realized they'd just been screwed. I tried to tell them a joke that I was used to go over good in high school. Didn't go over good there. Why'd you get in your bunk and shut up? Remember being in that bunk and the ship moving around like this, and it's hot in there? And these guys start talking about what they'd been doing in San Francisco. I mean, I'd done a few little sins, but these guys were number one ace sinners, big time. They'd been doing things, they'd been doing sexual things. I don't want to give the wrong impression. You know, at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And these guys were doing it with people. I couldn't believe it. Then I suddenly realized, of course, they've all got black hair. Those are the Catholics they told me about. But they were tough. Eventually became the ship fool, which was it's a good job, you know. Hey, kid, go down to the engine room and get us a left-handed wrench. Hey, kid, go up on the bridge, tell the captain we need some elbow grease. And they'd sink and drink. After every watch, they'd drink whiskey and raise hell, and I'd land my bunk and think, how terrible. And one day, one of these guys turned to me with his bottle of whiskey and says, how about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for a little snort? And I drew the line at that because despite all my weaknesses, I am a Norwegian Lutheran. And I decided to just demolish this guy. I was going to say, all right, you. I happen to be a Norwegian Lutheran. I guess you didn't know that, did you? But we don't drink whiskey, and we don't even talk to people that do most of the time. And I promised my mother and grandmother I would never drink whiskey, and don't you ever put that in my face again, and I'll just do something terrible. I was just going to say that. And he said, well, do you think you're man enough? And I heard a voice say, God damn right. So I had my first drink of whiskey out of the first bottle I ever saw close to. And it burned my mouth and my throat and my stomach and my throat and my mouth and his shirt, finally. Get the bottle away from the son of a bitch. To this day, I don't know a worse feeling than public humiliation, where someone just makes you look like a fool and you can't do anything about it. I wanted to hit these guys. I thought later, there's one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. It had thrown me overboard, but it would have been cute. Lean over, you. Yeah. Take that. Just give one of the old eye. But all the way across the Central Pacific, when nobody's looking, at least once a day, I'd sneak in these guys' sea bag to take a drink of whiskey. And I'd throw it up and have to wipe it up. And I just hated it. But I had some kind of a fixation. If I could drink that and not be vomit, they'd think I was a man. Nothing would have made him think I was a man. But that's what. And we were coming into Pearl Harbor finally, the night before my 16th birthday, still digging up ships. And I'm there with that damn bottle again. And I went down. And it stayed down. Then I couldn't breathe. And I don't know how long it was, but eventually, all of a sudden, I had a remarkable feeling. I had a feeling of intensely superior feelings. and I felt like something. And I had no idea that you're not supposed to get that big of a charge out of a drink of whiskey. But I did, and I loved it. And I discovered why people drink whiskey. I mean, you know, I always envy people who have breakthroughs in AA, because I never had any breakthroughs to speak of. I hear these guys say, when I had my first drink, I walked into a garden of experience, full of flowers and fruits to be savored, until the fruits and the flowers soured in my lips. And I came to this wonderful program. Sure. All I learned is if you don't puke and you can breathe, it makes you feel good. And I didn't become a terrible alcoholic. The next day they took me to Honolulu and got me 3 bottles of beer. And I got drunk and they thought it was funny. I thought it was funny. And that was the start. Later on, when I got old enough, I went in the Navy and took some. When I got out of the Navy, I was in a naval hospital in San Francisco and they passed around some tests. And I've always been good at tests. So I got a high school diploma. I'm still a junior in high school. I went back to Wisconsin after the war, and I went to the university and won some trophies for the university. Met a girl with black flashing eyes and black hair, just the kind of thing you never see in the Lutheran church. And she won my heart, and then she dropped a big one on me. I'm a practicing Catholic. I didn't know what to do, but she had me. So we got married. And I went out in the world and became a sports writer, newspaper sports writer, which to this day is my favorite job I ever had. But then my wife began manifesting the habit patterns of Catholics that I knew nothing about and nobody ever told me. And if you're a little Protestant boy, I'll tell you something. If you marry a Catholic, a good Catholic, you are about to have a big family, kid. Yeah. Whether you want one or not. I became a national distributor of small Catholics. I remember saying to my wife, can't we use birth control? No. But I have to laugh now. I look back. I don't know what I would have done if she had said yes. Here I was. I'd been in the Navy. I'd gone through 4 years of a major university. I knew a lot about life, but I had heard the word condom once and maybe in my life. In a Navy training film, they showed this voluptuous girl and explained what would happen to you if you did not use a condom. At that stage of my life, I didn't care what happened to me. Me. Yeah. But in that era, what you'd find is kind of wayward boys saying things like, I got a rubber. And even they would be ashamed to buy. Then they'd have to hire someone to go into the drugstore and say, hi, give me some cigarettes and some rubbers. Now, look how much progress we've made in the last 50-some years. The Rite Aid drugstore over my house, kids come in, they look pretty young. They say things like, hey, give me a box of rubbers and some cigarettes. Yeah, so, change. So I had to get better jobs, and I needed more money, and I got advertising and public relations and working in big corporations, And eventually, all these years I drank and raised hell and had fun. If you're new tonight, I'm going to tell you something odd. Alcohol is the best friend I ever had. I never had a better friend than alcohol. Friends come and go. Jobs come and go. Lovers come and go. Cities come and go. But when a few drinks is just making that difference, boy, wherever you are. As Bob said today. You get that feeling if you're an alcoholic at an AA meeting, and you get that feeling from a few drinks. And it just, and looking back, I suppose what it did for me, it just makes the scale go away. And I'm okay. But then you get sober again, the beer is back a little more. But I loved it, and I handled it, and I did it very well. You know, recently again, I saw on television this movie, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I don't know if you've ever seen that old version. Spencer Tracy and Ingrid Bergman. And this doctor, he wants to see what it's like to be, he's so wonderful, he wants to see what it's like to be evil. So he makes up this stuff and drinks it. And you learn something about it. Never drink anything that's smoking. Because that's what he did. And you get and he crossed town with this prostitute played by Ingrid Bergman. He's beating her. And she said, Jesus, shut up. Then he comes back and has the drink of that stuff and goes back to good old doctor again. He does this a few times, I think I understand that. I've done that many times in my. I mean, I'd go out and find Ingrid Bergman, but just let's go to Juarez. And you want to be around people who are saying, "Yeah." I don't want to be around people who are saying, "Why? It's so late." What did I tell Betty? Tell her to keep you home, you puke. Yeah. And when you go to have fun. And what destroyed Spencer Tracy finally, he puts all his stuff away. No more of that. I've learned my lesson. He's going over to be married to his virginal girlfriend, played in a triumph of casting by Lana Turner, dressed in white. And he's going through the park to walk over there, and all of a sudden, he never gets there. He's over beating the hell out of Ingrid Bergman again. He didn't drink anything this time. And from then on, this was a perpetual battle. He never knew where to go over, and eventually the throngs tracked him down and killed him. That's almost the story of my drinking life. As long as I could go over and come back, great. And I had some fun, but eventually I start going over when I didn't intend to go over. And my daughter says, "You weren't home at my birthday. I only stopped for a couple of drinks. I meant to be there. I don't know what happened." And on and on and on. Pretty soon it deteriorated. I meant to get to work. Meant to do this. And I'd go on the wagon. And that was so painful. I realized my problem can't be alcohol. It's these emotions or something wrong inside of me. And drinking is the medicine for it. But this time I got to watch it. In chapter 3 of the book, it describes it well. The thing that people, alcoholics of our type, seem to have in common, one thing, is that somewhere along the line, we have voluntarily or involuntarily had to accept the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. And says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursued into the gates of insanity and death. Because I know the problem is not alcohol. I once started going to AA, and because I was at some heat on me, I went to AA for a while, and my problem is not like these guys. Their problem is caused by alcohol. My problem is caused by something inside of me. If you're new tonight, you wonder what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's quite simple. It's a place where alcoholics go. What are alcoholics? Easy. People whose problem is alcohol. And they come here, and they admit their problem is alcohol, and they return to God, as it says on those steps, and then you help others and you live happily ever after. I only have a couple of problems with that. My problem is not alcohol, and I cannot return to God. Because by this time, if God exists, I am certainly damned. And so I had to find intellectual rationalizations around that. And it went up and down, and finally went down and didn't come back up. And in a period of a few days, all of a sudden, my wife and children left me. The company where I worked for, I'd been a big executive, pulled away my car. I was evicted from my house legally. Stood in a street corner in Dallas. I thought, how can this be happening? And the next thing I knew, a guy gave me a car to drive to Los Angeles. And I got as far as Phoenix and got drunk and lost the car. Never did find it. Thrown in jail that night for fighting with a guy. In the middle of the night, a guy kicked my front teeth out in the drunk tank. So now I have no teeth and I'm bleeding and I have no clothes, no nothing. And there's only one place to go when you look that bad. I came out of Phoenix to the jail. And I didn't know where to go. There's one place to go. You can always go to an AA club, because the worse you look, the more they like it. Oh, look at this one, Earl. He's mine. And I hustled some old lady for $20, and I got a bus ticket to Los Angeles, and there I was. Nobody came up to me that morning. I just stood in that street corner, and I was dying. And I finally said to some guy, I said, "Where's the AA club, pal?" He said, "Well, there's no AA club around here. It's out in Wilshire and Fairfax. It's a Wilshire doesn't even go down this far. You have to go up this hill to Hill Street and cut over to Wilshire and walk west." Okay, I'm going to get off the street. I'm going to die. And I walked and counted later my car, about 7.5 miles. That's a long way to walk when you're sick and your mouth is bleeding and nobody cares. And I walked into that stinking old club and the same old goofy steps and stupid traditions and falsely charming people and stupidity out in every corner. And I hung around in that club. I waited for it to stop raining. And that night they had a meeting, and I ate about 4 pounds of cake because I could chew that. Went to a meeting on gratitude and almost vomited up again. I just kept raining. I said to the manager of the club, I said, I thought I better put on my newcomer look. I said, I'm a newcomer. And I have no place to stay. The club is closing. It's midnight and it's raining. Could you help me? He said, yeah, you're in luck, kid. A guy named Joe Quinn left an old 49 Merc in the parking lot last summer. You can sleep in that. It's dry. I said, you want me to sleep in an abandoned car? He said, yeah, good deal, huh? Yeah, thanks a lot. That's good. That went on for days. The manager of the club said, you know, you have to be a member to be in this club in the daytime. You can go to the meetings at night, but you're such a mess. You can come in the daytime, but you can't ask anybody for money, and don't get smart and don't swear. And I hung around there, and I had no idea that would be my sobriety date. Didn't want it to be. I don't want sobriety. The one time I ever stayed sober, and I gave it all I had, what I used to do from time to time in my career, when I drink just the right amount, it's necessary for me to counsel police officers and point out their errors and shortcomings. So I've been in jail a lot overnight, just overnight. Throw the son of a bitch in the tank, Archie. And I got sorry, come out in the morning, go home, take a shower, and go to work. But this morning I came out, and a guy was waiting for me, a friend of mine, said, oh, you should have stayed home last night. I know. I'm going to straighten up. It's got to be different. He said, no, while you're out drunk, your little son died, and we couldn't find you. And I had a bunch of little girls, four little girls and one little boy. And he was the idol of my eye, I'll tell you. And he died. And I felt so bad about that, I just couldn't stand it. I still remember going up to Wisconsin to bury him, sitting in the living room with my father-in-law, my brothers-in-law, two big, healthy farmers. And they were so nice to me. Here, Clancy, have some coffee. Have some coffee cake. But in their eyes, you could just see, you dirty bastard. Look what you've done to our sister, you know. And before he died, before they buried him, I put my hand in his casket. Nobody's looking. I said, John Immersland, this will never happen again. I swear to God, it'll never happen again. And I went back to Texas, and we did pretty well, my daughters and I. My problem with alcoholism always was, the alcoholic can't quit. I can quit. And I can quit, and I've done it many times. My problem is, after I quit, in a day or two, or three or four, a week, somebody seems to sneak into my bedroom and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next morning, they start to tighten it. And it doesn't come out as, I need alcohol. It just comes out as a little growing restlessness. A little irritability. Just a little tired of taking these sermons, ongoing sermons for people. A little bit tired of getting these warnings. A little bit tired of, I'm sober now, get off me! And that tension mounts. And eventually, you get to a point where I've spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis and read books and traveled and did a lot of things. But nothing cuts that feeling like two or three drinks. And that's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler. Then sometimes I drink too much. They say, see, your problem was alcohol, wasn't it? I say, yeah, I guess it was. But I know it wasn't. I want to just shriek, no, it wasn't. My problem is not alcohol. You don't understand. Nobody understands me. And I got along with my family pretty well for a while. Suddenly one night somebody put into my room and put a spring in my gut. The next day I started to turn. And now it was on the really bad. And I had a new thing going for me. This stinking God, because I had been bad, took my little boy who never committed a sin in his life and killed him to punish me. What kind of a God would do that? And screw you! Whatever you do to me after I'm dead, I'll do nothing for you when I'm alive. And so that's how I get when I'm sober. Why in the world would I be sober now? The reason I'm sober is because it kept raining and I hung around that club. And I fell into the hands of a guy who impressed me because I'd seen him in the movies. I'd seen him a couple times in the movies. I thought, this guy's a movie star. He must have a lot of money. I bet he'd like a new friend. And I hung around him a little bit, and they started that same old fanaticism that they do in AA. Get a sponsor. Pretty good sponsor. I'll get this boob to be my sponsor. And he became my sponsor. And he said, I want you to do what I tell you. I said, oh, sure, Bob. I had a plan. I was going to get some money from him, get some teeth, get some clothes, go to New York, get a good job, make some money, save it, come back to Los Angeles, buy the AA club and burn it down. They say the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking and also to burn down the AA club. That works too. But I found out later he didn't like me. And I don't blame him at all, because I don't want to brag, but I was the worst type of newcomer there is in the world in AA. And I know, because I've sponsored two or three of them. The kind of people, when they walk into a room and say, hi, you just wish you had a pistol and say, here's your hi, boom, boom, you're dead. And that kind of person is a person who's been around AA year after year and knows all about it, but keeps drinking and coming around and demanding attention and talking about getting beefs, argument. And they're just wretched. And that's the way I was with a lot of people. But what happened to me, we don't have a lot of time, so I just want to jump over it quickly. Over a period of time, what my sponsor did for me, I pretended to be an alcoholic, so I thought it was the thing to do. And one day I heard him say to somebody, I don't know if it was to me or somebody else, he said, you know, as long as you think your problem is alcohol, you're going to die drunk. Oh, Jesus, Bob. Where's that coming from now? Is this a Screen Actors Guild breakthrough, or what the hell is that? And over a period of time, he explained something to me that I never had thought about. He said, you know, kid, there's a lot of people come here. People come today with an alcohol problem. But people like you and me don't have an alcohol problem. Because there's a solution. If you've got an alcohol problem, you shouldn't even be in AA. You're wasting your time and ours. I said, what the hell are you talking about? He said, look, if your problem is alcohol, here's how you overcome it. You stop drinking, you clean up your act, and shape up, and you're fine. I said, that doesn't work, Bob. I've done that 200 times. He said, that's right. That's because your problem wasn't alcohol. Well, what was it, Bob? Was I troubled by psycho-cybernetics? Shut up, he explained. No, it's something that sounds like alcohol, and a lot of people die because they never recognize it. It's something called alcoholism. I said, oh, Jesus, Bob, don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than hell. Alcohol, alcoholism, hooray, I'm well. And he got mad at that. He got mad at a lot of things. But over a period of time, he explained this. Over a period of a couple of days, he gave me a lecture, and most of it I got rid of out of my head, but some of it stuck. And that by itself didn't keep me here, but it got me started when he pointed out to me, an alcohol problem was overcome by stopping drinking. However, in this strange thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding thing called alcoholism, you'll discover that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, nobody ever told me that before. They always say if you get sober, you're supposed to feel better. He said, if you're an alcoholic, getting sober is worse. I said, well, if that's the case, then why do people drink this stuff if they know it's so bad for them? He said, people like you and me don't drink it because it's bad for us, kid. Now, you've been around AA a long time. If you're an alcoholic, you have an unusual ass reaction to alcohol. You know what that is? I said, yes, of course. You drink and you have a compulsion to drink more and you can't stop and all that crap. He said, nah, that's podium talk. The reason people like you and me drink is because something it does for us. And we don't know it's an unnatural thing. He said, but looking back, I can see it. He held up his cup of coffee. When I drink, it almost instantly changes the way things look. When I have a few drinks, it almost instantly changes my relationship to the world around me. When I drink, it almost instantly makes me taller and more self-contained, and them smaller and less threatening. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? And he said, I wouldn't talk this way, but he did. He said, it's because it isn't really happening, you asshole. It's all in your head. I said, okay, now you know that. Now it's getting you in trouble. Why would you drink then? And he said something else that the more I think about how true it is. He said, kid, remember this. People... Like us, all people, when you grow up, You're born, you grow up, you face conflicts, you have to deal with problems, learn to cope with problems, learn conflicts, how to work a solution to them, stay over anything that bother you, go for things that are good for you. He said that process is called maturing. And if you become a mature individual, you live rather comfortably in the world. All of us know mature people. They get along well with people. They get along in their jobs. They get along with their neighbors. They play with their kids. They're just wonderful. He said, this almost never happens to alcoholics. I said, why not, Bob? He said, because when people like us get long-term problems or conflicts or situations, we drink and get rid of them. Here's to you, Mr. Collins. Take your job and shove it. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. And what I'm doing, although I don't realize, I'm building a big closet full of bad reactions to emotional stimuli. And the day comes in my life and yours, I'm sure. Okay, enough of that crap. I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to straighten up. I'm going to make a life and stop screwing around. Go to work every day on time. Get along with people. And never once realized it is impossible. It can never happen to me. Because sooner or later, someone will do something that will trigger one of those reactions. Someone will hurt my feelings. Someone will do something to me. I don't have very many reactions like, I quit! Or I'll get you, you son of a bitch! What are you doing this to me? You're screwing me around! All those childish emotions come out. We call them alcoholic emotions, but they're childish emotions are what they are. And eventually I get in so pretty. Situate. Out of hell with you. And the three of the great words, while I was drinking, maybe you do too. Now, I need alcohol. What's the use? What's the use, for Christ's sake? And then later wonder, what happened? I didn't mean to lose that job. But the way it goes. I said, Jesus, Bob, I've done that for 10 years, more than that. That's the story of my life. I never heard anybody describe it like that. He said, there's a name for people like you. I said, what could it be, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. I'm thinking, my God, I'm an alcoholic. I've been sitting in AA meetings for 10 years thinking these idiots and their little steps and how much you have to do. And that's what it is. I said, why doesn't AA explain it the way you do, Bob? Instead of this allergy of the body and obsession of the mind, all this crap. He says, they do, kid. Read the first one on that board. He says, you have to admit you're having a problem with alcohol. Then there's a dash, which means end of thought, beginning of new thought. And now you must admit you're having a problem without alcohol. And if either one of those things were not in effect, you wouldn't be here. And I'd say the same thing to all of you here tonight. If you could still drink, you'd be out drinking. If you could stay sober comfortably, you'd be out staying sober comfortably. When you can't do either one, you wind up in rooms like this looking for a way out. Oh, I can't be an alcoholic. I've been in jail 100 times. Let's have a drink. And it's a great, great breakthrough. I think that was in December of 1958, a long time ago. And I've known I was an alcoholic ever since. And I've had some bad times, especially in my early sobriety, because things didn't get better very well. Because I had a bad mouth, I had a bad attitude, wearing hand-me-down clothes. And sometimes I thought I was going to drink, but I made a decision. I will not drink. I will give myself permission to commit suicide when it gets this bad. And I got close enough a couple of times, way beyond drinking, but not quite to suicide. And little by little, I had a sponsor who I came, little by little, I did things that I'd never done before. Sometimes I felt so bad, I would confess to him my weaknesses. Oh, I hated that later. You know, strong people don't mind talking about their weaknesses. Weak people, that's all you got to. Oh, you won't like me if I tell you. But little by little, he told me dumb things to do and I'd do them. And I eventually began to get the strange feeling. This guy seems to know how I feel. I never knew anybody that knew how I felt. My dad didn't. My doctor didn't. My minister didn't. Nobody did. They all said they did. We know how you feel. No, you don't. No, you don't. But he knew how I felt. And you think, what's so important about finding someone that knows how you feel? Because we've all had enough advice to last us 10,000 years. But if you find somebody who knows how you feel, what they say may be meaningful information that you may act on that you never would otherwise. That's what one of the great things you do here is act differently. And I remember doing things that he told me to do that I would never do for anybody else. I remember standing at the Brentwood meeting, fancy meeting, old clothes, just 6 blocks from where later O.J. Simpson didn't kill his wife. And he's saying, see that woman over there? Yes, Bob, I don't like her. Well, I want you to apologize to her. Why should I, Bob? I was told that you called her a bitch at the Monday night meeting. She is a bitch, Bob. Why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girls to stay away from me. Well, she's right. You apologize. I don't care who told me that. I'd have said, no, you apologize. I'm going to go over and embarrass myself in front of that old bag and make myself look even worse than I am. Screw her. But it was somebody that I believed knew how I felt for the first time. Bitch. I didn't quit a job because he told me not to. I went back to a meeting where they treated me badly because he told me to. And little by little, he had me do actions that changed my life over a period of time. When the day came I was going to commit suicide, finally, he used that pain to get me to write an inventory, which is something I swore I'd never do, because I'd take an inventory with a psychiatrist. I'd take an out-of-work actor, for Christ's sake. And little by little, my life changed. By the time I finally held a job when I was 2 years sober as a beginning writer in a medical corporation. Still had no front teeth. Went to work every day like this. They thought I'd been burned in a fire. They didn't know I didn't have front teeth. And people would hurt my feelings. Now, instead of quitting, I'd call Bob and he'd tell me how to treat. And little by little, by the time I was 5 years sober, I was a director of advertising for that medical corporation. I was 5 years sober. Had teeth. Smiled a lot. So anybody here among you new people who have lost teeth, let me give you some hope. Once you become spiritually pure, they grow back. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought to Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio, became the number one hard rock station in the world. We all wore shiny suits and said things like, what's coming on down, baby? Jesus. When I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations for an oil company. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Dallas, leaped out of their post office box, rushed to my side. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Thank God somebody gave me a book on the rhythm system and ended all that crap, you know. They're all grown up now. 3 of my daughters are turning 17 this year in AA. The other kids aren't alcoholics, apparently. And only one of my kids turned out bad, and you hate to talk about it because these sort of things bother you, but my oldest daughter has become a judge. We had so hoped for a defense attorney, but no. She's coming home this weekend for Father's Day. She says, she thinks it's cute. She said, Daddy, remember when we were little girls used to send us to our room? I said, sure, honey. She says, when you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room. But that's nice. And the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, it turns out, we're out of time now, but the purpose of AA, it turns out, it's not to get you sober, not to get you drier and drier, because you only get so dry. The purpose of AA, it turns out, is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast, to little by little change your perception of reality. The same things look different. To little by little change your relationship to the world around you. To little by little make you feel taller and more secure, and them smaller and less threatening. And it did that in my life little by little. I didn't do very well. I mean, you hear recovery stories like, it was just wonderful. How? But for most of it, it's not like that. It's like, oh, I found a new life. Oh, Jesus Christ. And ups and downs, but it's a continual up. When I was 15 years sober, I was doing very well, and I found myself AA changed me more than I wanted to be changed. And one day I found myself resigning a job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 32 years I've been the managing director of the Skid Row mission that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why would you want to do that? And I can't even think of a good answer. Well, for such a significant decrease in salary, I couldn't pass it up. I'm still looking for those two guys. Once I get them, I'll be out of there. Yeah. This morning I went to work. I got up by the ocean where I lived, said goodbye to my family, got to Santa Monica Freeway, went downtown, went through Beverly Hills where I used to work. My car still wants to get off at La Cienega. And I parked my car and walked around the mission, stepped over the bodies of dying men and women and children, dying from alcoholism and drug addiction and insanity, and went inside, and a bunch of us worked as long as we could before I had to come and catch the plane on how we can save these people's lives. You know, if we're not a treatment center, we're way below that. But it's a funny thing. When I leave there at night, I always seem to feel a little bit more like a man than I ever did going down those elevators with my shiny suit popping my fingers. But I have become a wonderful man. What Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is little by little make me live in a world that's friendly. And over if I had a little more time, I could tell you how I couldn't come to return to God, but I came to believe in my sponsors, my higher power. And as a result of that, I came to believe in AA as my higher power. And sometime later, I came to believe in a God that listened to what I said. And I remember turning my life and my will over to the care of my sponsor because I couldn't dare to do anything else. And all these little by little, the steps have come true. I find myself in a situation living like people I used to sneer, sit in the back row and sneer at, think, you idiots. Now, and it's that way all over. It's that way all over. It's amazing if you're new, you think you're different. But all over the world, there are people who have all the feelings you have. We are so similar. You know, I don't want to be cosmopolitan, but Tuesday of this week, I was in Singapore. And the weekend before that, I was in Bali. And the week before that, I was in Norway talking of things. And you'd think there'd be really different AA in those places, but except for the accents, you had the same thing. Every group in the world boils down to this, and I'm sure this group does too. In every group, there's a group of people who've come to AA, sullen and withdrawn, but little by little been pushed into taking these steps, and their lives change. In every group, there's a bunch of people who don't want to do these things, and they stay on the outside and hang around the side and carp and complain and call the people who are doing them Nazis and crazy people. And in the middle, there are new group, new people. And both of these groups fight for their souls. And I'm glad we saved some of them, because the arguments against AA are better than the arguments for it. They can make it sound so intellectual. And AA is such a remarkable thing. And after you're here a while, that stupid book that's almost unbelievably bad to read becomes smarter and smarter and smarter and smarter. And one day you'll find yourself living with some degree of confidence and courage in the world. And that's why meetings such as this are so important. This, I believe, is a pocket of enthusiasm. There are people going out to help people. There are people going into hospitals. And you got to ignore the carping voices that are on the edge of the group who want to change it, who wanted to do something else. This is the best meeting in Nevada by far. And I think it's a testimonial to the people who started it. I've spoken here at every anniversary, and I've watched it form. And I'll tell you, I'm pleased to be invited here because I'm an activist at AA and I love to go where there's activist AA. I want to commend Bob and Greg and the guys that started this and kept it going. And don't let whiners and shirkers change it. You've got a deal going. And this is designed to help these people who are new, to teach them about AA till they come to realize they're an alcoholic. Those steps will change their life. They will come to believe in a God that will change their lives. And you'll wonder how you ever could have doubted it. Thank you.